Welcome to Monday, June 19th, and welcome to KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke.
We want justice! We want justice! We want justice! We want justice! We want justice!
That sound is from a vigil last night outside an apartment complex near Seattle's Magnuson Park. Family and others gathered for 30-year-old Charlena Lyles. She was shot and killed by police on Sunday morning. KUOW's Patricia Murphy has been following this story. Welcome, Patricia.
Thanks, Bill.
Why were the police headed to Charlena's apartment yesterday morning?
Seattle police say shortly before 10 a.m. they were called to the apartment to take a burglary report. The apartment complex is in the Sandpoint neighborhood. It is a permanent housing building for formerly homeless people. It started out pretty straightforward.
The information that the officers were responding to was it was a burglary call. The suspect was no longer on scene, and it was basically we need officers to come out to take a report.
Patricia, how did this turn from officers just needing to take a report into a fatal shooting?
Yeah, that's obviously the big question right now. Seattle police says it started out really as a straight-up burglary call. They said Lyles was known to them, that she had had contact with the police recently. This is why they sent two officers to the apartment building. But right now, there are no real clear answers about what went from A to B in this situation.
The Seattle Police Department has released tape of the event. This is dash cam audio?
This is audio from the police officers.
From on their uniforms.
Mm-hmm. Get back. Get back. Good. Last second. Hey. Get back. Hey.
Okay, you ready? We need
help. We need help. One or two now. Hey, get back.
We need help. Get back. Get back.
Yeah.
And gunshots?
Yeah. So what we hear on that tape, obviously, it's about 4 minutes long. It's partially redacted by Seattle Police Department. But for the first 3 minutes and 30 seconds of it, it is literally just her and the officers talking about the burglary, that she had stepped out. She had left the door unlocked. They took the Xbox. Yes, they took the Xbox. And then somewhere around 3 minutes and 30 seconds, things just start to get a little noisy on the tape. You can, you know, it's no longer a discussion. You can hear the officers calling for help, telling her to step back. She has an expletive that we have bleeped in there, but it's really five shots are fired at the end of that tape.
Patricia, you were at a vigil last night for Charlena, and we heard a little of what that sounded like a couple of minutes ago, but let us know more. What was happening there?
Yeah, it was a very well-attended vigil. A lot of friends and family members turned out to talk about Lyles as a person. You know, they called her a devoted mother of several children. One of her children had special needs. They talked about her struggle with mental illness and her abusive relationships. But mostly during that vigil, what they said is that she should not have been killed, that this was racially motivated. Her sister Monica says she was too small to be a threat. She said police should have used less lethal means.
My nephew had to step over his mother's body to get out of the house. What 11-year-old boy deserves to go through that?
There were three children in the house at the time. Seattle police has not confirmed whether they actually witnessed the shooting, but if you listen closely to the audio that SPD released, you can hear children in the background.
And what is Seattle Police Department saying about this shooting?
Well, they'll obviously conduct a thorough investigation. It's getting a lot of scrutiny from the community. The mayor has talked about it. Everyone seems to be talking about it. So a long time from now, we'll get some answers maybe.
We'll continue to report this story. That's KUOW reporter Patricia Murphy. Thanks, Patricia.
Thank you.
On KUOW's Facebook page, people are sure talking about it, grappling with what happened yesterday morning. There's still so much we don't know. Amy writes, how on earth does this happen? She had a flipping knife. April says, I really don't understand shooting someone with a knife, even if they have mental illness. And Emma says, I feel so sorry for the woman and her kids and her family. I also feel sorry for the cops, she writes. I feel like they're not provided with good quality training. I don't think they woke up this morning thinking about killing someone. Again, there's so much we don't know. That's why we'll keep reporting this story for you on KUOW Seattle. It's KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. How is the Republican agenda playing and working out in Washington state? President Trump has been slumping in the opinion polls. Even the one poll he tweeted about last week that showed him at a 50% approval rating, that one's back to 48% today, lower here in Washington state. Let's talk national and local politics with our state's Republican chair, Susan Hutchinson. Welcome back to KUOW.
Thank you, Bill. It's great to be here.
What are Washington Republicans saying to you about President Trump?
They like him. They really do. If there's anything, people are frustrated with Congress not moving faster, but we all know that Congress moves at a glacial pace because it takes a lot of people to put together legislation. But we get a lot of letters from Republicans because we send out a lot of letters asking for their support. And most everyone we get is very positive about the president.
How do you know how accurate a gauge that is? Because President Trump got 38% in Washington state, and his approval ratings nationally, I don't know whether you poll in Washington state about President Trump, but he's not doing any better in the opinion polls than he was. What makes you think Washington Republicans are supportive?
Well, because Republicans voted for Donald Trump. There's no question that the vast majority of them did. And now, as they watch him implement his agenda, I think they're overall quite pleased with how things are going.
Did you vote for President Trump?
I did.
And any regrets?
No.
Okay. A former person, someone who used to hold your job, a former state Republican chair, Chris Vance, told us that he thinks that you're being too supportive of President Trump.
Too many Republicans have abandoned their principles, abandoned their consciences, become Vichy Republicans, and are working with the Trump administration because they think that's the only way to hold the Republican Party together. When you're a member of a legislative body, which I've been, you look very much to your party's leadership. What's our plan? What are we doing? What's the team going to do? To break with the team takes courage, and it's unusual. Right now, I think a lot of Republicans are just sticking with the team, even though they're becoming more and more uncomfortable. But you know what? I don't care if they're uncomfortable. This is the time to stand up and forget your party. Be an American. Stand up for the Constitution. The heck with your party's leadership. They're wrong. They're morally compromised.
So this is Chris Vance's numbers case, and I'll let you respond, is that Trump got 21% in King County. Bill Bryant, the Republican who ran against Governor Inslee, got 32% in King County. He says if a statewide candidate can't get 40% in King County, they can't win. He says the numbers don't add up. It's impossible. It's math. You can't get a majority in the House and Senate and can't win statewide if you continue to support Trump. What's your case?
Well, I just ran across this weekend a headline from the day after I was elected chairman of the state party. And the headline says, Hutchinson to lead, in quotes, ragtag army of GOP. And that was almost 4 years ago. And I can tell you that our Republican Party in Washington state is very united. And I've often said that we're a patchwork quilt of opinions on every issue you can think of. But when it comes to where we agree wholeheartedly and where we vote together is the future of America. And we want the American opportunity to prevail. And that's why people voted for Donald Trump nationwide. They were afraid that the America that allows every child born to access the American dream was slipping away. And so that's why Republicans support our president. And I think as we go forward, you know, the election was the election. There were a lot of prominent Republicans in this state who did not support the presidential candidate that the Republicans had chosen. But my job is to elect Republicans, good Republicans, to work with good Democrats to do good for the people of Washington state. And so that's my focus. And I'll tell you, we've got the greatest group of legislators in the state legislature that we've probably ever had on the Republican side.
Do you have Republicans lined up to run against Senator Maria Cantwell or a Democratic House member or for King County Executive?
Well, I think the King County Executive race, we'll just have to wait and see. But people are talking all over the place about Maria Cantwell's position, and we'll have plenty of candidates willing to step up to that race. And that's coming up now in about a year and a half.
Okay, I want to pose a question from our Facebook page. But before I leave that topic, Chris Vance, former state Republican chair, is he a good Republican, bad Republican? Anything you want to say? I'm curious what you think about someone who held your job before, you know, kind of railing, saying, no, you got to get off the Trump train.
Well, you know, people rail for different reasons. Uh-huh. And I just don't even think about it was more than 12 years ago that he was our chairman. And since then, we've had three other chairmen since Chris and
Kirby
so,
Wilbur
and Luke Esser.
Uh-huh.
And Diane Tibelius. So we've had a lot of leadership, and we've seen the party go one way or another. When I took over the party, things were need a little help, and so I've been really privileged to have been part of helping make that happen.
Here's a question for Washington State's Republican Party Chair Susan Hutchinson from our Facebook page. Lucia says, why is the Republican Party hiding the health care bill they're working on? You've heard about this. Even some Senate Republicans are complaining they don't know what's in this bill. What do you think?
Well, the bill that was passed out of the House is for anybody to read. In fact, there was a website called Read the Bill. And now they're in negotiations in the Senate. And I know that if there were any Democrats who were willing to negotiate and work on the health care bill, which they all should, they would be very welcome in the negotiation. So, you know, there's no question that there is a very odd culture right now of leaking. And the leaking is always against the Republicans and always against the president. And so, you know, I don't blame Republicans for wanting to be careful about who they talk to, because leaks are not very often accurate and they're very partisan. And we know that Senator Chuck Schumer has already declared that no Democrats are going to work on health care reform. Well, that's just so counterproductive. We don't need that kind of rhetoric inside our Senate. We've got to fix the situation we have called Obamacare. Everybody knows it. And, you know, people just have to swallow their pride and get the job done.
So if Democrats were to take control of Congress, you're good with this same process. You don't have a beef with keeping things relatively secret.
Well, I don't think secret is the word. I think that, as I said, anyone who wants to get involved in the negotiations will be part of negotiations from either side of the aisle.
There is news today about health care in Washington State. Health insurance rates here overall are rising. State officials say health insurers have proposed an average rate hike of 22%. And in two counties, Klickitat and Grays Harbor, no health insurer has filed plans. What's your reaction to that?
Well, this is what the president has been saying for months, what the Republicans have predicted for years, and that is that Obamacare was non-sustainable. This is the problem. You cannot pretend that there's a goose that's laying a golden egg every time you need money to fund a very extravagant health care program. And so that is why good Democrats and good Republicans should be working together to solve the problem of reforming healthcare to a program that works for everyone.
Here's the healthcare that President Trump promised Americans will get.
Everybody's got to be covered. This is an un-Republican thing for me to say, because a lot of times they say, no, the lower 25%, they can't afford private. But
universal health care.
I am going to take care of everybody. I don't care if it costs me votes or not. Everybody's going to be taken care of much better than they're taken care of now.
Who pays for it?
The government's going to pay for it, but we're going to save so much money on the other side. But for the most part, it's going to be a private plan, and people are going to be able to go out and negotiate great plans with lots of different competition, with lots of competitors, with great companies, and they can have their doctors, they can have their plans, they can have everything.
Everyone will be taken care of much better than they are now. Lots of competitors, you can have your doctor, your plan, and everything. And President Trump has said he's not going to cut Medicaid and Medicare. Can you promise those things too?
Well, it sounds pretty good to me. Doesn't it sound good to you?
Sounds wonderful.
He said that as a candidate. I believe that's a soundbite from when he was running for office. Is that accurate?
That's a good question. I don't remember. Why is that important?
Well, because candidates say some things and then they come up with reality and they realize that it's a little bit harder than words. So I agree that the concepts are right. Healthcare for everyone, competition, extremely important, and that the entire country is happy with the solution. So that's what we need. We're looking for unity, we're looking for coverage, and we're working for competition, which brings prices down.
But are you saying that President Trump has confronted the reality that those promises are not going to come true?
No, I think putting you know, the words that you speak when you're on the campaign trail to legislation that is that can pass both houses and then also satisfy the American people takes a lot of work and a lot of negotiation. There are many different constituencies working on healthcare: the medical profession, the doctors, the patients, the pharmaceuticals. You know, it just goes on and on. I could probably add 10 more. Mm-hmm. All of them want to have a say, and all of them want to come out winners. So this is the nuance and the deft negotiation that is required as we move forward. And, you know, one thing I think is important to remember about President Trump, if you've met him, as I have several times, you realize that he's really an interesting person because he is so interested in you. He asks you questions immediately. There's no small talk. He wants to know what you think, and then he follows up. It's not just
he was vetting you for a cabinet post.
He was asking me
or an ambassadorship.
He was asking me questions about how we can win Washington State, how we could win Oregon. What about California? We were talking about it. It wasn't small talk. It was he's fascinated with other people's opinions and other people's brain power. When you have a chance to meet him, Bill, you will like him very much. But one of the things that people don't understand about a New Yorker, now my mom's a New Yorker, so she was born in Brooklyn and raised in New York. And so I know the style, and I know that it can be very frank and brash and no nonsense. You know, you say what you mean and you mean what you say. But with Donald Trump, he has a way of starting at the negotiation point. And I always say it was an interesting thing to watch when he went to Mexico when he was still a candidate. And he came out of there and he said, the Mexicans are going to pay for the wall 100%. Well, the Mexican president responded by saying, we're going to pay zero. Well, that was the negotiation starting point. 100% on one side, zero on the other side. I can assure you the negotiation will continue and both sides will get to a point where they can meet. And that's what Donald Trump does.
If he's saying Mexicans will pay 100% and in healthcare you're going to get everything you want, and you say that's just the starting point, that's the opposite of mean what you say and frank, right? I mean, that's okay if that's what you're saying, but that's not frank and no nonsense and mean what you that's say what you don't mean and then start negotiating, right?
Well, no, I think that Donald Trump would be perfectly happy with 100% of the wall paid by the Mexicans. But
that's hope more than a promise.
When you are negotiating, you cannot start where you want to end up. And a lot of people have learned sadly that you never want to give your opponent what they want from the start, because you've got a trade. It's a trade-off. So, you know, it's the way, it's the art of the deal, and I recommend anybody read that book who hasn't read it yet. I think you'll get a lot of insights into Donald Trump. He is not your standard politician in any way, shape, or form, and I think if we just move forward and accomplish those things that are good for the nation, we will all be a lot happier with him as our president.
Washington State Republican Party Chair Susan Hutchison. Before we leave health care, only 20 Republicans in America voted against the House health care bill, and two of them were Dave Reichert and Jamie Herrera Butler here in Western Washington. Why would that be if it's such a great, great bill?
I've not talked with either one of them about that, and I'm sure that they made that decision for reasons that they can explain. I would encourage you to have both of them on your show.
Well, maybe political reasons, because this is Chris Vance's point, is that you can't pretend that Washington State Republicans are like Republicans everywhere, that you've got to moderate things. And I know he was three chairs ago, but that's the argument, that you're sticking too much to that Reichert and Butler, they're in touch with their constituents. It's their jobs on the line, and they're voting against the president.
Well, we'll see.
We'll see.
We'll see.
Okay. I want to ask about a couple of local things. Seattle City Council is considering a city income tax, which right now is illegal by state law, if it's even constitutional. But why shouldn't the state let cities have local control? I know Republicans value local control. Would you be okay with a city income tax? Or would you support the state allowing local municipalities to decide whether they want an income tax?
Oh, I think it's a terrible mistake. Just a terrible
mistake. An income tax is, or allowing local governments to have it is a bad mistake.
Well, you can't allow local governments to have an income tax. That's absurd.
Well, there are cities with income taxes.
Name one.
Doesn't San Francisco have an income tax?
Well, they may have taxes, but I've never heard it called an income tax.
Hmm.
You know, the bottom line is that Seattle has not proven by any way, shape, or form that they know how to spend money. I think the situation with the homeless in the city and that number growing and growing and the number of deaths with overdoses and so forth, they can't spend the money they already have assigned to dealing with homelessness and addiction. Why in the world would we give them more money to waste? And that's, you know, that's where we start. But other than that, it is an illegal idea tax, that tax. And so it's absurd to think, and as our city council, I live in Seattle, I've lived here for more than 35 years. Our city council thinks that they're above the law. Our city council thinks they're smarter than the people. They think they're smarter than the representatives of the people that are working on issues in the state capitol. And it offends me tremendously, and it offends a lot of people. I was with some folks at an auction this weekend, a charity auction, and several of them said, I would move immediately out of Seattle if they implemented an income tax. But here's the thing that everybody should be concerned about. When you have an income tax, whether it's in your state or at the federal level, you have an entire bureaucracy that has to be built up so that they can handle every single person filing what their income is. We've never done that in our state. And so that is why these little foot-in-the-door attempts by the Democrats to tax capital gains income.
That's a state-level proposal.
It is. And that the Democrats have tried to do that several times. We consider it an income tax, especially an income tax on retirees who are living off money that they invested long ago in McDonald's and other companies that they put their money in for old age. When they start selling it, then they have to pay this tax above what the federal government requires.
Lots of states have income taxes. You're okay with Washington State being a relatively regressive tax state. Is that working? I mean, it's so hard to fund education. Look at the education.
Well, we've got a budget right now on the table that funds education fully. Funds it fully without an income tax. Now, let me tell you that Washington State is the second most taxed per capita state west of the Mississippi. That includes a lot of states. Second to, you can guess it, California.
Uh-huh.
We're second to only California, and we don't have an income tax. I guarantee you, if they had an income tax on top of the highest sales tax in the country.
What if they lowered the sales tax? Then you're on board.
Oh, I haven't seen a single proposal that says we should lower the sales tax.
Okay.
But you know what? A lot of companies move here because of the tax environment. And I think that's important to remember. A lot of people are moving to Texas. A lot of people have moved to Tennessee. Tennessee is booming. They do not have a state income tax. People realize they pay a lot of taxes. They can feel it at every turn. And so especially in this populous area of the three counties where we're now paying for Sound Transit at huge rates.
Let's pause it there. We've got so much to watch together, Susan, with the figuring out this state Supreme Court decision on funding education, and we've got a budget to write, and we'll see what happens with President Trump and everything he's dealing with. We've been talking with the chair of the Washington State Republican Party, Susan Hutchison. Good to see you again. Thank you for this.
Thank you, Bill. I'd love to come back and be with you.
Well, then we'll see you soon.
Okay.
More of KUOW's The Record coming up. It's The Record on KUOW. 94.9 Seattle News and Information. So, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, we learned today that the cost of health insurance is going up in Washington State. You heard a reaction from our state Republican Party chair. In case you missed it, some of the details, double-digit premium increases in many cases, 22% overall average rise. Two counties will have no insurers left in the state-run healthcare insurance exchange. That's Grays Harbor and Klickitat counties. So let's bring in the state insurance commissioner, Mike Kreidler. Welcome to KUOW, Mike.
Thank you, Bill.
So this is President Trump in Cincinnati earlier this month.
Obamacare is crashing. It's dead. It's in a death spiral, as the head of one of the biggest insurance companies said. It's in a death spiral. And we're coming out to do good, not to do bad, to do good.
president talking about Republican health care plans at the end there. Do you accept that things are moving in the wrong direction for Obamacare?
No, no, they're not. And I mean, you've got several studies that have documented that. You had a Wall Street firm that came out and did an analysis, and it showed that it was funding was stable in all, the vast majority of the states. The same thing with the Congressional Budget Office came up with numbers, too, in doing an assessment. So, I mean, the external reviews right now are that it's working, and it's working better in the state of Washington than any place else. Now, the only thing the Republicans can take credit for is that there's a huge amount of destabilization taking place presently from the standpoint of whether they're going to support the subsidies for cost sharing that currently is on a month-to-month basis, very much a destabilizing impact on the companies, increases their degree of uncertainty in the market. The same thing if the Republicans aren't going to enforce the individual mandate. If they'd back off and let Washington State do what it's doing right now, we'll do it just fine. I mean, there's some corrections to the Affordable Care Act. All of us would be, I think, willing to step up and say, let's make them, but we're doing pretty well.
Let's react to these couple of pieces of news today that state that health insurers have proposed an average rate hike of 22%. Why are insurance rates going up like that?
Well, there's a number of factors, and these are their requests to me. This, so I haven't approved these rate increases. This is just what they're asking for at this time.
Right.
So we're going to look at it very closely. I want to make sure that it's driven by real numbers. The number one driver for increased cost of health insurance premiums are pharmaceuticals. Let's make sure that the cost drivers are straight and right before, and if they are, it's very hard to turn your back on a company for wanting to make sure they're covered for actual costs. However, if it's being driven because of the uncertainty in the market, then it's a different ball game. In fact, Oliver Wyman, at a national consulting actuarial firm, just less than a week ago came out with a report saying that up to two-thirds of the rate increases coming forward are because of the uncertainty in the market around the subsidies for cost sharing and for potential non-enforcement of the individual mandate.
What about these two counties, Grays Harbor and Klickitat, who may have no options through the state's insurance exchange? So far, they don't.
Well, number one is I don't find it acceptable that any county not have health insurers in the individual market. It's incredibly important for all counties, but in particular, it's a challenge and always has been for rural counties that find it much more challenging to put together the kind of network of providers. The administrative costs are typically higher. So there's challenges both from the standpoint of the provider community and from the insurer community that were a problem before the Affordable Care Act and haven't gone away. We're seeing it now, and it's kind of bubbling to the surface, but it's one that I think we can get around. I'm still optimistic we can convince for those two counties to keep insurers in those markets going forward.
This is Washington State's Insurance Commissioner Mike Kreidler saying he's reached out to insurers to see if one is going to reconsider offering plans in the Grays Harbor and Klickitat County. Open enrollment for the 2018 individual market starts this fall in November, so we'll keep watching. Commissioner Kreidler, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Bill.
It's KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. A Portland band has won a victory that involves a racial insult. That and more just ahead.
Sorry if we tried too hard to take some power back for ours. The language of oppression will lose to education until the words can't hurt us again.
Singing about the language of oppression, that's a Portland rock band called The Slants, and they're celebrating a free speech victory today. In an 8-0 ruling, the U.S. Supreme Court decided the band's name can be trademarked. The term slants has historically been an anti-Asian slur, and that's the argument the government made. The term is racist. The government can't trademark that. Well, the members of The Slants are Asian Americans, and last year I asked bass player Simon Tam why he took on this legal battle over his band's name, a slur.
Because if you take that word away from everybody, you're also taking it away from the communities that need it, who can use it as a form of empowerment to gather power and to create social change.
I've also talked about this today with journalist Emily Bazelon, a staff writer at the New York Times Magazine and a senior research fellow at Yale Law School. Bazelon says the Supreme Court didn't base its ruling on some idea of social change. The justices didn't find the government's argument against registering the trademark compelling.
The Supreme Court said that this disparagement clause, this idea of rejecting trademarks because they're disparaging, violates the First Amendment's guarantee of free speech. And the court rejected the idea that trademarks are a form of government speech. So the main opinion by Justice Samuel Alito says, you know, every time someone uses the term the slants, people who hear it are not going to be thinking that the government is speaking. And so the mere idea of kind of affixing a trademark to something does not mean that the government is condoning the speech or approving it. And Justice Alito had this great line explaining why he thinks that registering a trademark is not government speech. He said, look, if trademarks become government speech as soon as they're registered, then the federal government is babbling prodigiously and incoherently. When you hear that kind of language from the Supreme Court, you know which side just lost.
What did he mean that the federal government is babbling prodigiously and incoherently?
I think he meant that if you imagine that it's the government speaking every time someone talks about a trademark, then the government would be saying all kinds of crazy, incomprehensible things, and that's just not a kind of common understanding of trademarks, that we don't think when we hear the term the slants, oh, it has a trademark, therefore the U.S. government just spoke.
I interviewed one of the Portland band members from the Slants, and he told me that there are already offensive trademarks, that the KKK trademarked its name. Is that true?
Right, and so this is a problem for the government. They're making a lot of subjective decisions about what's too disparaging and what is okay, and the inconsistencies and, you know, apparent contradictions in their internal decision making shows the difficulty of applying a standard like disparagement in a neutral manner.
Did you expect the U.S. Supreme Court to rule this way, or were you surprised?
I wasn't surprised. These justices are very muscular about the First Amendment. And what I mean by that is that when they see a challenge based on a free speech claim, they are often very sympathetic to the plaintiffs, and that is something that is true across ideological boundaries. So this decision was essentially unanimous, and that is why.
So now, Emily, does this mean game on? You can disparage all you want and get a trademark for it?
I think it pretty much does, and one of the big implications of this ruling is that the Washington football team that's called the Redskins will probably be able to keep their trademark. There had been a challenge that term is disparaging to Native Americans, and those plaintiffs in the kind of trademark office land were winning. But now I think the Redskins are going to be able to say, hey, this whole idea violates the First Amendment, and so we get to keep our name and our trademark.
This has been called a free speech case, and I suppose it is, but we're just talking about one narrow kind of speech. It's not like people's ability to be insulting was at stake.
Right. You know, trademarks are one way in which the government weighs in about language, but there are all kinds of ways that the public can express approval or disapproval of a way a company or an organization uses language, like the Redskins, like the Slants. And there's no reason at all why any of that changes as a result of this decision. So one way to think about this is that the Supreme Court is saying, let's keep the trademark office out of this. But the court is expressing no view at all about whether these terms actually are offensive or how we're supposed to make up our minds about that. That is still a choice that all of us get to make.
That is New York Times staff writer and senior research fellow at Yale Law School, Emily Bazelon, reacting to a victory in the U.S. Supreme Court today for that Portland rock band called The Slants. You can find my interview with the bass player from The Slants, Simon Tam. You'll find that at our website, KUOW.org. I wonder whether you agree with the U.S. Supreme Court that all offensive names should be eligible for a trademark. We want to hear from you. You can tweet us right now, at KUOW. You can give us a call, 206-221-3663, 221-3663, or you can email us, record@kuow.org, record@kuow.org. How has an offensive name played out in your life, and how do you feel about the idea that the U.S. government can trademark those names? You're listening to KUOW Seattle. Earlier this year, the Navy scraped the hull of the USS Independence to prepare it for dismantlement. That likely released heavy metals into the waters of Puget Sound, and that's bad for salmon and orcas. The Navy didn't get a permit for the work, so last week, environmental groups sued. And we wondered, how are people in Bremerton reacting? Joshua McNichols of KUOW's Region of Boom team went to find out.
Every day around lunchtime, Kenny Wayne Gunner stands on First Street in Bremerton and plays his electric guitar. Navy sailors walk by. Some drop a few coins into Gunner's guitar case.
Well, I wouldn't be able to be out here playing my guitar on the street corner if it wasn't for the Navy. God bless the Navy, and thank you very much for your service.
And it's not just Gunner the guitarist who's grateful for the Navy's presence here. Bremerton Mayor Patty Lent feels grateful when a new aircraft carrier comes to town. The Navy picks her up in a helicopter and flies her onto the deck of the ship.
Well, it's pretty exhilarating. First of all, I haven't been in a lot of helicopters, but I've got the earphones on and the helmet, and I'm all strapped in. But it is, for me, my dad and grandfather both were Navy, and it's just something that I'm privileged as a mayor to do that.
The Navy scraped the ship so that it wouldn't carry harmful barnacles and snails to Texas, where it would be cut to pieces. But the EPA still wants to keep tabs on scraping like that, because paint comes off too and gets into the water. Lent says she can't support what the Navy did. Still, she understands why the Navy acted that way. It had a tight deadline to move this ship.
That's when it was going to be moved, and they needed to make sure it was going to be ready to go.
Mayor Lent says she would have loved to help broker an agreement with the environmental groups. She said she knows how to talk to the Navy.
I think we could do it together collaboratively without lawsuits.
In a statement, the Navy said it performed the hull cleaning in an environmentally sound manner, consistent with the Navy's long commitment to the health of Puget Sound. Jack Stanfield takes a more skeptical view.
I knew it was BS.
He's a Bremerton resident who used to work in the shipyard. He says back in the 1980s, the Navy used to let asbestos, lead, and PCBs get into the water, but a lawsuit forced it to start cleaning up properly. For a while after that, he says the Navy did a great job.
And so I was shocked, disappointed, and angered when I found out that these yahoos are, once again, out here doing their own thing, and to hell with the public, and to hell with the environment, you know?
Welcome aboard the Washington State Ferries.
From the deck of the ferry, you can see where the USS Independence had its hull scraped before it was towed off to the scrapyard. Caitlin Kinn leans over the rail and points.
It was just beyond the carrier we can see here over on the other side.
Kinn works for Puget Soundkeeper Alliance. That's one of the groups that filed the lawsuit against the Navy last week.
The Navy is a major player here. The Navy is largely, it's one of the entities that's largely responsible for the historic pollution in this waterway. That's one of the reasons I think they need to be taking a lead in its recovery and in its restoration.
Kinn says it's up to groups like hers to file lawsuits when other government agencies are unable or unwilling to hold the Navy accountable. Ultimately, this issue is bigger than Bremerton and its relationship with the Navy. This water is part of Puget Sound. That's a connection this ferry traces as it makes its way from Bremerton across the Puget Sound to Seattle. In Bremerton, I'm Joshua McNichols, KUOW News.
KUOW's The Record on Twitter, @KUOW. I'm Bill Radke. So last week we told you Amazon's buying Whole Foods, and since then we've been taking this in, learning about what Amazon might have in mind and how important this move might be. It's certainly a marquee thing to do. Let's talk to GeekWire co-founder Todd Bishop. Hi, Todd.
Hi, Bill.
It's big, but you know, one company buys another company, happens all the time. What are you thinking about how much whole Amazon Foods could affect our lives?
In a couple of different ways. Amazon, first off, has made this push in a small way into brick-and-mortar retail. You know, it was a big deal when they opened their first bookstores. They've started getting more into grocery now. But now you see them making this giant bet, $13.7 billion, biggest acquisition in their history.
This by is, far.
By far. Yeah. Tenfold.
Yeah.
This signals that Amazon is going heavy into physical retail. And that's the first place where this could start to change our lives, because Amazon brings such a tech heritage to the retail world. And that then has a ripple effect, not just on the properties they own, but also on everybody else. You've seen the Fred Meyer Krogers of the world start to offer their own grocery pickup services, you know, almost in anticipation of what Amazon might do. It just drives this ripple effect throughout the entire grocery world and through the retail world.
So is your take that the future of grocery buying is going to be in some big measure online, and that Amazon is just the first of many?
Online, but also digital. If you look at what Amazon has done, they've taken the best of both worlds, in their view. They've taken this whole notion of seamless experience that you would get in a browser, but you take that to the store, for example, with their Amazon Go experimental store, where you just walk in, scan your smartphone, pick the item off the shelf, and it knows who you are.
This is the one in Belltown that's still sort of in beta.
That's right. And the word is that it's not working as well as they had hoped. So you can see that there are some hiccups along the way here. That said, the whole idea of just having your persona, your online persona, follow you throughout the online world and the physical world, that's really where Amazon is bringing all these things together. And so you can see with the Whole Foods acquisition where, for example, they might have an Amazon Fresh pickup location in the Whole Foods parking lot. Now, I should be clear, this is speculation on my part, but it's logical speculation.
Well, they're doing a couple of those stores in Seattle, right?
That's
Soto
right.
And Ballard.
That's right. You can imagine how with this giant footprint.
This is Amazon,
that's
by the
right.
way, not Whole Foods. But
that's
Amazon.
Right. Amazon is 450 stores approximately in the U.S. that Whole Foods has. Concentrated in some big markets. I was actually just looking at the numbers this morning. They have Whole Foods more than 80 stores in California.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a giant presence in some selected, very important markets. You could see where Amazon could use that footprint to start to essentially have its own tentacles out into the world, where they might have a distribution center in the back of the Whole Foods that would then serve other kinds of Amazon products. So just really a sea change and a big accelerant for the things that we've already started to see at Amazon.
Okay, so again, though, Amazon is big and Whole Foods is biggish, and so they might work together. But help me understand how this is going to affect my life as a consumer. Like, I go shopping. You said my online self sort of is follows me. Flesh that out.
So let me give you a great example. The Amazon Fresh Pickup service in Ballard. I've been using it a lot. One of the things that Amazon does, you might not even know that they're doing it, but you can drive up, they scan your license plate the first time unless you opt out.
Okay.
The next time you drive up, they don't even have to ask who you are.
Yeah.
Because they see your license plate, they've associated that plate with you already.
My oil change place does that already when I'm pulling up.
That's right. So that is really bringing this whole online world. And
but what do they do with that information? So they know who I am, meaning
they know
what?
You are.
They know I love avocados?
They don't even have to ask who you are. They just bring your groceries straight out. You don't have to even log in. Your license plate is essentially logging
okay.
in for you.
Okay.
And so if you compare the way Amazon goes about the physical retail world to things like Fred Meyer, like I also use the ClickList service over at Fred Meyer, and it's so much more cumbersome. You've got these traditional retailers trying to become digitally savvy, and it works much better the other way around when you have a digital native company figuring out how to apply the tools of technology to the real world. It's just better.
Are you saying I've already ordered online, or are there certain things that I just that I'm always going to want once a month, and so I pull in and they know who I am, and they just load it into my car.
You order online.
Yeah.
You still order manually online.
Okay.
But if you go to the...
I still need my brain.
Yeah, for now.
Okay.
For now, you still need your brain. But if you go to the traditional grocery store experience, you get out of your car, they scan your card. You know, it's a much different, much less seamless experience, and it's just an illustration of how much Amazon can bring to the physical retail world.
What's the big deal about groceries? Amazon's clearly really into groceries.
It has been a challenge for Amazon ever since 2007 when they rolled out Amazon Fresh as a beta, a pilot in the Seattle region. And the one big challenge is that the margins, the profit margins, are very thin. It's a very difficult business to make money in. Now, that is one place where Amazon does well. And so if they can disrupt that, if they can really provide a better experience at less cost, then they can take on this big mammoth industry that everybody needs. Everybody needs food. You don't need clothes necessarily. You don't need to buy new clothes every month.
Not in Seattle. It only gets so hot and so cold, but I got to eat.
Right. Absolutely. So it's obviously just basic sustenance. And if they can get themselves in at that core place, then they have a real stronghold over everything. So it's really a core offering.
Do you have any thoughts about whether Whole Foods and every other grocery store becomes all robot?
Yes, I think down the road, so a couple things. First off, if you look at Amazon's distribution centers, its fulfillment centers, as a guide, they will tell you, hey, what this has done is it's opened up more capacity. We have more robotics and we have more humans because those robots are enabling the humans to do more. If you look at the Amazon Go convenience store, you know, it has far fewer employees in a theoretical sense than a typical grocery store.
You don't need cashiers.
That's right. So I could see it taking away some element of the workforce. Now, Amazon has been very clear. There are no layoffs planned in conjunction with this specific acquisition. Now, down the road, could they eventually, as they expand Whole Foods, have fewer employees per store? Definitely, that is a possibility.
Any thoughts about other low-margin businesses that Amazon disrupts, says, hey, it's a hard business, but we're good at that hard business?
Yeah, I don't know about low-margin necessarily, but fashion is another area that they have been getting into.
Why fashion?
That's just one area where they see the traditional department stores, the Nordstroms, even the Costcos of the world to some extent. You know, mm-hmm. You can get your dad jeans at Costco. even those kinds of retailers can be disrupted by this online model being applied to the traditional retail world. And so, fashion is another area. And of course, we've seen Amazon come out with its own private label products where they put the Amazon label on things like electronics and home goods. And I think you're only going to see that trend continue, especially as you have a new retail outlet for them to put those goods into.
Before we're talking with GeekWire co-founder Todd Bishop, and before we open our microphones, we were checking the stocks of some of those big competitors, and most of them are still falling. They fell big yesterday with Amazon getting into their business. We looked at Kroger and Target and Costco and others. How close is Amazon to being called a monopoly and broken up?
You know, that is an interesting. When we were debating this in the office last week, I think you would be hearing more about the potential for a monopoly if they were trying to acquire Walmart, sort of their peer in the physical world. I think Whole Foods is still niche enough. Obviously, this is going to require regulatory approval, but I think it'll probably go through and it won't face nearly the level of scrutiny that it would, perhaps even under the Obama administration, as it will in the Trump administration. It'll receive less scrutiny in the Trump administration than it would have in the Obama administration, and it'll receive less scrutiny than it would if Amazon was trying to acquire another giant like Walmart.
Is a hallmark of monopolies, though, that the price goes up? And if Amazon's not raising prices, then it doesn't matter how big they get? How's that work?
That is one hallmark. And just sort of dusting off my recollection of how Microsoft got itself into trouble, it wasn't enough that they were dominant in one market, in operating systems in their case. They also had to try to leverage that monopoly illegally to get into another market, browsers or applications. So you can be a monopoly, as I understand it, and our legal experts out there might correct me, but you can be a monopoly and still be okay as long as you're not abusing that monopoly from a regulatory standpoint. Now, acquisitions are something else entirely, and regulators can scrutinize those heavily and require people to sell things off to avoid amassing more market power.
Any final thoughts on Amazon, Whole Foods, big moves by this local giant?
To me, I wish I could get into a time machine and see what a Whole Foods store will look like in 3 years, and also what the prices at Whole Foods will look like in 3 years, because that is the hallmark of Amazon, as you're saying. They push prices down.
Yeah.
Their big book dispute was over, you know, Apple wanting to essentially set the price too high for ebooks, and Amazon wanted to push them down. You know, Whole Paycheck, maybe it's not going to be Whole Paycheck anymore. Maybe it'll be a three-quarters paycheck instead.
Right. Some people were joking about Bezos having to pay so much above the stock price and saying, see, you cannot go into Whole Foods and walk out without getting gouged, Bezos.
That's right.
Okay, we've been talking with the co-founder of GeekWire. Always good to see you, Todd Bishop. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill.
It's The Record.
It's getting real in the Whole Foods parking lot.
Yeah,
I got my steel and you know it gets sparks alive. I'm on my grind, homie. Uh-huh. It's on my mind, homie.
Yeah.
These fools with clipboards are looking at me like they know.
They don't know.
It's getting real in the Whole Foods parking
lot. It does get real at Whole Foods. Thanks for tuning into The Record. I'm Bill Radke with a quick sports update for you now. It was only 4 months ago when former Husky Kelsey Plum scored 57 points at Heck Ed Pavilion to become the all-time leading scorer in all of women's Division I basketball. Now she's out of college. She's playing professionally for the worst team in the WNBA.
Oh, get out! There's a career high! Fifth block for Breanna Stewart!
Get out. You're just another block by the Storms, the Seattle Storms' Breanna Stewart. They're stuffing Kelsey Plum. Plum was back in Seattle yesterday with her new team, the winless San Antonio Stars. And it's been a rough transition to the pros so far for Kelsey Plum. So far this season, she's scoring about 4 points a game, fewer than two assists, shooting 24% from the field. That's not good, and yet they still love her in Seattle. The Key Arena crowd chanted, Kelsey, all game long. Thanks for tuning in to The Record on Twitter at KUOW, and join us again tomorrow for The Record.
This Buster's on his iPhone talking to his friends, picking up some cayenne pepper for his master cleanse. You're the most annoying dude I've ever seen, brah. Could you please move? You're right in front of the quinoa. Damn, I'm about to check out. Pay my $80 for six things and get the heck out. The express lane is moving hella slow.